Welcome to the deep dive. You know, if you look at the history of computing, it's basically this giant swinging pendulum.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it.
Right. I mean, room-sized mainframes gave way to the personal desktop, and then that gave way to the centralized cloud. But today we're looking at a single historic snapshot, July 24, 2026.
Right, the Tekken Night Report.
Exactly. And on that night, the pendulum didn't just swing, it split right down the middle.
It really did.
Because on one side of the globe, you had artificial intelligence moving into these silent, invisible chips running locally on your own personal devices. And then on the other side, it was consuming gigawatt-guzzling supercomputers the size of entire city blocks.
Yeah, which is just wild to think about happening simultaneously.
It is. So our mission today is to unpack this briefing, the Tekken Night Report. We're going to figure out how computing became hyper-local and unimaginably vast on the exact same night. Mm. For you listening, if you want to understand where the technology in your home, your car, your workplace is heading for the next decade, this report is an absolute goldmine. It connects all the dots.
It really is a phenomenal snapshot in time. I mean, we see a lot of isolated product launches in the tech sector, right? So it's really easy to lose the forest for the trees.
Right, totally. Just a flood of information.
Exactly. But what this report does is trace a clear, undeniable through line. We're looking at seemingly disparate leaps from, you know, Microsoft and OpenAI to Tesla, Apple, NVIDIA.
Yeah.
But when you actually unpack the engineering behind them, you realize they're all reacting to the exact same physical and economic constraints of the AI boom. It's a single massive shift in how humanity interacts with machines.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the software that we interact with every single day. Hmm. Because July 24 saw a massive shift in the power dynamics between Microsoft and OpenAI.
A seismic shift, really.
Yeah, Microsoft rolled out their new in-house models, MAI Image 2.5 Pro, and MAI Voice to Flash. And the numbers attached to these releases are just staggering. By running their own optimized models, Microsoft achieved an 89% reduction in GPU inference costs compared to using OpenAI.
Which is just, I mean, that 89% figure is a fundamental rewriting of cloud economics.
They're massive.
Because for years, Microsoft was essentially footing the bill for OpenAI's computing costs. They were racking up astronomical operational debt on NVIDIA infrastructure just to run these gigantic models for, you know, every simple user prompt.
Right. Checking the weather shouldn't require a supercomputer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So to fix that, Microsoft had to figure out how to do a lot more with a lot less.
And the way they achieved it with their voice model, the MAI Voice to Flash,
yeah,
is like the perfect example of that efficiency. They use something called text-to-waveform direct synthesis.
Yes.
Which, the best analogy I can think of for this is, imagine you're trying to fly from New York to London. The old way of generating AI voice was like a multi-layover connection. You spoke to the computer, a program converted your speech into text, then that text went to a language model to get a text reply, and then another program converted that text back into synthetic speech.
Which was so clunky.
Right. Super prone to delays. But Microsoft's new model is a direct flight. It skips the text transcription entirely. It takes your raw acoustic audio, processes the meaning, and generates acoustic audio right back.
And the result of skipping all those layovers is that latency drops to under 120 milliseconds.
Wow.
Yeah, and that is a critical threshold. Anything under 200 milliseconds is where the human brain perceives a conversation as entirely natural.
No awkward pausing.
Right, no walkie-talkie effect. Yeah. And because it skips the text phase, it actually preserves all those nonverbal cues. Your emotional cadence, the background acoustics, the actual tone of your voice.
But the report details that Microsoft didn't just make it faster, they completely changed where the model lives. They use this technique called 4-bit quantization.
Yeah, that was the game changer.
From my understanding, it's kind of like taking an enormous, ultra-high-definition RAW photograph and compressing it down into a tiny JPEG file. It takes up a fraction of the stored space and memory, but to you, the user, the output looks virtually identical.
That's a great way to look at it.
So Microsoft shrank their MAI models down so small that they don't even need to live in a massive cloud data center anymore.
Mm.
They can run locally on the neural processing unit the MPUs build directly into Copilot Plus PCs.
You hit the nail on the head, and those new laptop MPUs are incredibly capable. I mean, the report notes they're hitting 45 TOPS.
Which is trillions of operations per second.
Exactly. Your thin and light laptop is now doing 45 trillion math calculations every second, specifically dedicated to AI tasks.
That is insane.
It is. And by shifting the workload from the cloud down to the edge to the user's local machine, Wall Street is projecting a $4.5 billion gross margin expansion for Azure by 2027.
Because they just aren't paying for the server electricity anymore.
Right, your laptop battery is paying for it.
Which, incidentally, solves one of the most stubborn hurdles in enterprise tech data privacy.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if the AI model is running entirely on my local 45 TOPS processor, my proprietary corporate data never leaves my network. It doesn't get beamed up to some public server where it could be intercepted or, you know, used to train a future model.
Spot on. But, and this is key, OpenAI did not take this shift lying down.
No, they definitely can't remove.
Big time. While Microsoft pulled operations locally, OpenAI pivoted to make their cloud-based AI this indispensable, omnipresent agent. They launched GPT Live.
Right.
And that brought full duplex, sub-200 millisecond voice control directly to coding environments and the ChatGPT desktop app. So now a software engineer can just verbally dictate application architecture or ask the AI to refactor hundreds of lines of code without even touching their keyboard.
And that term you used, full duplex, it's the secret sauce here. It means bidirectional audio, like a telephone call, not a walkie-talkie. You don't push a button to talk, and you don't have to wait for the AI to finish its paragraph before you chime in. If it starts writing Python code and you realize it's going down the wrong path, you just interrupt it mid-sentence. You say, actually switch to a ternary operator instead, and it just instantly halts, recalculates, and adapts.
It's a profound shift in software engineering ergonomics. And the screen parsing capability is what makes it feel like absolute magic. GPT Live is analyzing active window buffers at 30 frames per second.
It's literally watching you work.
Yes. It sees your screen in real time. It understands the UI elements in a design app like Figma. It reads the error logs in your terminal. It knows exactly where your cursor is hovering.
Wait, hold on, though. I read the part about GPT Live pulling continuous audio and screen data, and my immediate thought was corporate espionage.
Yep. The security question.
Right, because if I'm a defense contractor or Fortune 500 firm, having an AI stream my engineer's unreleased source code and private conversations back to a cloud server, that is a massive security red flag. How is a major company allowing this level of surveillance?
It is the single biggest barrier to entry for cloud AI. And OpenAI had to engineer a very specific cryptographic architecture to overcome it. First, they implemented end-to-end TLS 1.3 encryption.
Okay, so like a digital armored truck.
Exactly. Only the sender and receiver have the keys. Second, enterprise subscribers get a strict zero data retention guarantee, which is audited to SOC 2 Type 2 standards.
Meaning a third party actually verifies it?
Right. It's an exhaustive audit proving that OpenAI servers automatically delete the data the millisecond the session ends. No human sees it. It's never saved to a hard drive.
But the report also mentioned local keyword filtering, right?
Yes, and that is the cleverest part. Before the audio or screen data even enters that armored truck to go to the cloud, there's a tiny local algorithm acting as a bouncer at the door.
Oh, I like that. A bouncer.
Yeah, it actively stands for confidential tokens, environment variables, proprietary source code snippets, and if it sees something classified, it just blurs it out or mutes the audio locally. The sensitive data never even hits the network card.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And honestly, the physical benefits are undeniable. I mean, if you suffer from RSI repetitive strain injury or carpal tunnel, this interface is life-changing.
Oh, complete.
You can just whiteboard a complex back-end system out loud while pacing your office, and the AI quietly generates all the boilerplate code in the background.
And that transition from the digital keyboard to the physical voice is so crucial here, because this deep integration, it isn't stopping at software development.
No, it's crossing over into our physical bodies.
Exactly. OpenAI isn't just listening to developers' code anymore. They are now reading our physiological data.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The relaunch of ChatGPT Health on July 24 is arguably the most intimate application of technology we've ever seen. They fully integrated it with Apple Health.
Which is a huge deal.
It is. We are way past the era of just counting daily steps. This system continuously syncs your heart rate variability, your sleep architecture stages, your VO2 max, all directly into a generative AI reasoning model. Yeah. And the way it uses heart rate variability, or HRV, to monitor your autonomic nervous system is fascinating.
It really is.
Because HRV tracks the minute variations in time between your heartbeats.
Well,
high variation usually means your body's relaxed, you're adaptable. Low variation means your fight or flight system is constantly engaged.
Which means the AI can detect acute physiological stress spikes during your workday before you even consciously realize you're stressed.
Yes. and the system will actively intervene. If it detects your nervous system redlining while you're, I don't know, staring at a massive spreadsheet, it automatically prompts a micro rest break. It initiates haptic box breathing exercises via your Apple Watch.
It literally taps your wrist.
Right. It physically taps your wrist to pace your inhales and exhales. Your AI is stepping in to regulate your biology.
It's the definitive shift from reactive symptom tracking to proactive health optimization. I mean, historically, the medical paradigm has been wait until a patient feels visibly ill and then treat the symptoms.
Right? Well, yeah, totally reactive.
But by synthesizing continuous wearable sensor data with AI reasoning, the system identifies the latent microscopic indicators of physiological strain. It spots cumulative overtraining, early signs of illness, or circadian disruption days before the human even feels the fatigue.
But again, just like the software developers, my brain immediately flags the privacy risk here. My Python code is one thing, but my continuous heart rate and sleep data, that is my most vulnerable information.
Oh, absolutely.
I do not want that being used to train some advertising algorithm.
And the privacy architecture had to be airtight for Apple to agree to this partnership. So all biometric processing happens inside the Apple Secure Enclave.
Which is that dedicated, isolated chip on the device, right?
Exactly. It's physically separated from the main processor. The data is encrypted at rest using AES 256 keys, which is essentially bank vault level cryptography. It would take a supercomputer millions of years to crack. OpenAI mathematically verified that user health telemetry is strictly segregated in a walled garden. Zero training on user data.
Okay, that's reassuring. And the report highlights how this bridges the gap between consumer wearables and actual medical professionals, too.
Yeah.
It lets you export all these long-term biometric trends into a format called HL7FHIR.
Right.
Which I know sounds like alphabet soup, but it's actually the universal data language that global healthcare systems use. So it translates your Apple Watch telemetry into the exact standardized format your doctor sees in their clinical charting software. You're not handing your cardiologist a messy Excel sheet. You're handing them a structured medical-grade report.
And the specific biometrics it correlates are highly clinical. I mean, it mentions continuous nocturnal blood oxygen CFPO2 to flag potential sleep apnea warnings. It utilizes the ECG sensors for AFib warnings.
It even integrates with continuous glucose monitors.
Right.
Like from Dexcom and Abbott.
Yes, exactly. So you can map your exact glycemic spikes against your sleep data and your meal logs to calculate your baseline insulin sensitivity. It's a real-time metabolic coach right on your wrist.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
But parsing desktop screens at 30 frames a second, generating millions of lines of code, capturing billions of biometric data points, processing all this biological and real-time data requires an immense amount of energy and hardware.
A staggering amount.
And speaking of physical hardware and energy efficiency, the physical manufacturing world just had its own moon landing moment. Because the digital world is completely bottlenecked by the physical power grid.
Which is why Tesla is the missing puzzle piece to this entire report.
Right. Tesla officially shattered the $100 per kilowatt hour industry barrier. They achieved a $75 per kilowatt hour production cost on their 46 NE80 cells at Gigafactory Texas.
And hitting $75 per kilowatt hour is the holy grail for electric vehicles.
Yeah.
That is the universally recognized threshold where manufacturing an EV battery finally reaches cost parity with building a traditional internal combustion engine.
And the mechanism behind how they achieved it is a total manufacturing marvel. They perfected a dry cathode process, which... The best way to understand why this matters is to compare it to how batteries are traditionally made.
Right, the wet slurry method.
Exactly. Traditional manufacturing is a lot like baking a cake. You take all the active battery metals, you mix them into wet chemical slurries using these highly toxic solvents called NMPs. You spread that wet goop onto long strips of foil, and then you have to run those foils through massive 100-meter-long drying ovens.
Just to evaporate the liquid away.
Right, to leave just the solid material. It's incredibly slow, and it uses a staggering amount of electricity.
But Tesla's new dry coating process eliminates that wet phase completely. It's much closer to pharmaceutical manufacturing, like making a pressed pill.
Yes. They eliminated the toxic solvents and those gigantic energy-guzzling ovens entirely. Instead, they just mixed dry powders with specialized fluoropolymer binders, basically a high-tech glue, and use high-precision calendaring rollers to press that dry powder directly onto the metallic foil under immense pressure.
And the ripple effects of that transition are monumental. By removing those drying ovens, Tesla cuts the manufacturing energy by a factor of 10.
10 times less energy.
Yeah, It shrinks the factory footprint by 70%, which obviously drastically lowers the capital expenditure required to build a new factory. But more importantly, it makes their planned $25,000 compact EV highly profitable. And it puts crushing pressure on legacy automakers who are still stuck paying $110 per kilowatt hour for wet slurry cells.
And it's not just cheaper to make the space. The dry cathode batteries are fundamentally better products. Because they use those advanced binders, the internal structure is much more stable. The cells degrade less than 8% after 2,000 full charge discharge cycles.
Which is fantastic longevity.
Yeah, and the internal electrical resistance drops too. Lower resistance means less heat buildup, which allows a driver to add 200 miles of highway range in just 12 minutes on a 350 kilowatt V4 supercharger.
Wow.
Yeah, without the battery thermally throttling.
And we really shouldn't overlook the environmental impact at the end of the battery's life either, because there's no chemical solvent residue baked onto the foils. Recycling facilities are achieving a 99% closed-loop recovery rate for the lithium, nickel, and cobalt.
So the battery just becomes a totally reusable resource.
Essentially, yes. And that brings us perfectly to the final piece of the Tech in Night report. Because the exact same dichotomy we see in Tesla's hyper-efficient manufacturing and OpenAI's massive scale, it's playing out in the very silicon chips powering our AI.
The great silicon arms race.
Exactly. On one end of the spectrum, we have the triumph of localized efficiency. The report detailed the leaked specs for Apple's upcoming M3 Ultra workstation chip, built on TSMC's 3-nanometer process.
And the engineering on this chip is wild. Apple uses this packaging tech called UltraFusion, which uses over 10,000 microscopic silicon trace lines to literally stitch two separate processor dies together.
So they act as a single unified brain.
Right. And the specs are almost hard to fathom for a local workstation. A 32-core CPU, a 48-core GPU, and 192 gigabytes of unified memory. But the spec that stands out the most is the memory bandwidth that operates at 800 gigabytes per second.
And that bandwidth number is the entire key to Apple's strategy here. They are betting heavily on local enterprise AI because the biggest bottleneck in AI isn't the processing power of the chip. It's how fast you can shove data into that processor.
Right.
Think of it like a genius reading a book. The genius is the processor, but the memory bandwidth is how fast you can turn the pages. By opening up the data pipes to 800 gigabytes per second, Apple is allowing developers to run massive 70 billion parameter models completely locally.
And because it's built on their highly efficient silicon architecture, it does all this heavy lifting at a peak power draw of just 180 watts. It's cooled completely silently by internal vapor chambers. You have supercomputer-level AI performance sitting quietly on your desk, pulling less electricity than two old incandescent light bulbs.
Right. Apple is entirely optimizing for that hyper-local, decentralized AI. But on that very same night, NVIDIA revealed the complete opposite approach.
Yeah, the ultimate manifestation of centralized scale. So what does this all mean? I was reading the specs on NVIDIA's flagship reveal, the GB300 NVL72, and the numbers don't even seem physically possible. It's a single rack containing 72 Blackwell GPUs, 36 Grace CPUs, 30 terabytes of high bandwidth memory. It outputs 1.4 exaflop PS of compute power.
Just to contextualize that, an exaflop is 1 quintillion floating point operations per second.
A billion calculations.
Every single second. Just a few years ago, that level of compute density was exclusively reserved for secretive national laboratories taking up entire buildings, and NVIDIA just packaged it into a single commercial rack.
But here is my fundamental question with this. A rack pulling that much compute power requires 120 kilowatts of electricity. How do you even power or cool a single rack that costs $3.8 million? Conventional air conditioning literally cannot cool that much localized heat. If you just blew a massive fan on it, the servers would physically melt.
You are entirely correct, which is why NVIDIA had to completely abandon traditional air cooling. To prevent the silicon from destroying itself, they engineered a closed-loop direct liquid cooling, or DLC, infrastructure. They pump specialized coolant directly over the microscopic processors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the coolant absorbs the heat and exits the system at around 45 degrees Celsius, which is about 113 degrees Fahrenheit.
So they're essentially building high-tech radiators for these chips.
Yes. And because this completely eliminates the need for those massive energy-hogging mechanical chillers that data centers traditionally use, hyperscalers are getting really creative. They're actively routing the massive waste heat generated by these racks directly into municipal district heating networks.
You're kidding.
No. The AI compute infrastructure is literally becoming a sustainable hot water and heating source for the surrounding cities.
Okay, That is a brilliant piece of engineering.
Right.
But what are they actually doing with a quintillion calculations a second? I mean, you don't need an exaflop to run a customer service chatbot.
No, they're using this scale to solve scientific problems that were mathematically impossible until now. With that exascale power and these fifth-generation NVLink switches, which actually use light instead of copper wires to transmit data, they're solving molecular docking 100 times faster for drug discovery.
Wow.
Yeah. And meteorologists are simulating real-time atmospheric fluid dynamics. The system even natively interfaces with quantum processors to run real-time quantum error correction bridges.
So to bring this all together for you listening, July 24, 2026 marks the day the architectural pendulum of computing really split. On one side, we saw this massive architectural shift toward hyperlocal efficiency. Microsoft's compressed MAI models, Apple's M3 Ultra chip, Tesla's dry coating manufacturing.
Giving us incredible power locally, efficiently, and privately.
Right. And on the exact opposite side, we saw unimaginable central scale. NVIDIA's liquid-cooled supercomputers and OpenAI's omnipresent GPT Live agent. Computing is becoming deeply personal and staggeringly massive at the exact same time.
It really is. And, you know, this leaves us with a truly profound thought to mull over.
Yeah.
Think about it. We have NVIDIA superclusters simulating millions of robotic scenarios per second to train physical machines. We have Apple and Microsoft giving those AI models the ability to run locally on your laptop with zero latency. And we have ChatGPT Health monitoring the minute variations in your continuous heartbeat to regulate your autonomic nervous system.
It's all connected.
We are rapidly closing the loop between the digital and the physical. If our AI can now perfectly code its own software, if it can proactively diagnose our bodies and simulate physical realities to design its own hardware, at what point does this technology stop being our tool and instead become our environment?
Wow. At what point does it become our environment? That is the perfect question to leave on. The pendulum hasn't just split. It's actively building an entirely new ecosystem around us. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Tech at Night report. Keep questioning the scale, keep spotting the trends, and we'll see you next time.